Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to introduce this week's episode. One of the things that interested me when I was a young Mormon kid was why church seemed to be so much more interesting in its early years. I was especially fascinated by the descriptions of the Kirtland Temple dedication, where people said they saw angels and visions and spoke in tongues. Does stuff like that always happen in the temple? I wondered. And, as I would later find out, no. At least, not for me. I don't know, maybe there's another room in the temple that they just never let me into. But there was something that I didn't learn about the Kirtland Temple dedication until I started contributing to Josh Baird's Mormon Tarot Patreon. Why, yes, an artist from Southern Utah has been busily creating a tarot deck based on Mormon history and scripture. I've been following his progress for a few years now, and he's come up with some really interesting stuff. You should totally check him out. Anyway, it was from his Four of Wands card that I found out that wine was a part of the Kirtland Temple dedication. Not only that, but it was wine after fasting, which gave it an extra kick. And I thought, wait a minute, does that mean a lot of the visions of the early church period could have been helped along by substance ingestion? It struck me funny to begin with, but then I remembered that a lot of cultures use substances to facilitate their rituals. Maybe things were different pre-Word of Wisdom. Today's episode is about the possibility of hallucinogenics being a part of some of the more interesting stories of Mormon history, including what Joseph Smith called the church's first miracle. The presenter is Bryce Blakeneagle, host of the Naked Mormonism podcast. This was recorded at the 2022 Salt Lake Summer Symposium.
By way of a disclaimer, of course, we discuss substances and substance use, and in no way should this be perceived as an endorsement for experimentation or use of psychedelics or hallucinogenic substances, especially considering the current illegality of many of the described plant materials. So with that out of the way, let's begin. In 1829, a man named Solomon Chamberlain was chasing some rumors which led him to the Smith home in Palmyra, New York. He knocked on the door. The man who answered was Hiram Smith, the oldest surviving brother of Joseph Smith. Solomon asked and was answered, quote, "Is there anyone here that believes in visions or revelations?" And Hiram's response is a fascinating one. He replied, "Yes, we are a visionary house." Joseph's groundbreaking biography, No Man Knows My History, it made a poignant statement when Fawn Brody said this, quote, "Like any first novel, the Book of Mormon can be read to a limited degree as autobiography." And the opening conflict within the Book of Mormon centers around this concept of visionary. The visionary Lehi and Nephi are our comic book heroes, while the idolatrous or the materialistic Laman and Lemuel become the villainous figures who evolve to become the villainous dark-skinned Lamanites once the journey to America is complete. The lesson for readers to take away from this: visionary peoples will always be misunderstood, and materialistic peoples will always murmur and curse those of visionary pursuits. For people in the 1830s who converted to Mormonism, this was their first exposure to the tenets of the burgeoning church. They may have heard the story of an uneducated farm boy, Joseph Smith, being visited by an angel and being led to the golden plates, priming their minds for the supernatural nature, or the visionary nature of the content within the Book of Mormon. The investigator then began to read, and they may have seen themselves, their own lived experience, within the first chapters when the visionary Lehi is scorned by the wealthy elites in the great and spacious building. Lehi wants to share this visionary world that's caused by the plant materials that he ingests, and he bids his family to join. Some do join him, and they are treated in the text with favor, while others do not, and they become the idolatrous villains. The claimed provenance of the gold plates, coupled with the tone and the content of these first stories within the text, it created a selection bias of early converts. Those materialists, the idolatrous folks reading the Book of Mormon, they viewed it as anything from, you know, Bible fan fiction to absolute heresy, like Alexander Campbell did. They seldom converted to the church absent exterior pressures. However, those with the visionary mindset, like Sidney Rigdon, they immediately connected with the material, and they saw something greater than a piece of 19th century Bible fan fiction. It spoke to them. It validated their own visionary experiences. This community of early Mormons would readily receive such visionary converts into the growing visionary house of the church. And Joseph Smith was quick to recognize fellow visionaries. The first miracle in the church, according to Joseph Smith himself, involved one of these visionary individuals struggling to accept some of the content within the Book of Mormon. His name was Newell Knight. Joseph told Newell Knight to go into the woods by himself and pray. Newell did just that, and he began to become ill, and he returned home. Now, his described symptoms in the history of the church, described by the prophet, they seem to indicate nightshade toxicity or solanacea toxicity, that being the ingestion of datura or belladonna or hemlock or something of that, one of the hexing herbs. Quote, "His visage and limbs distorted and twisted in every shape and appearance possible to imagine, and finally he was caught up off the floor of the apartment and tossed about most fearfully," end quote. Impaired motor control, convulsions, these are the external symptomology which help us document or chronicle the usage of specific psychedelics or hallucinogens within the early church. But they say very little of Newell's internal perspective. Joseph found Newell Knight in this situation and recognized him, quote, "suffering very much in his mind while his body was acted upon in a very strange manner," end quote. Newell and Joseph had specific roles to play in this drama. Newell was fully convinced that he was possessed. He was acted upon by an external supernatural force or a being. Joseph would play the role of the exorcist. Now, here it is important to note the utility of nightshades used for entheogenic purposes. Psychedelics in general, they cause our brains to operate in ways that are not normal to our everyday perception. And for many users, they believe that the plant materials simply catalyze an ability to perceive a realm of existence that's more real than the world that we inhabit. Users will blast off through a gateway in order to achieve expanding awareness, right? Psychedelic terminology, it's inherently vague like this, and especially for uninitiated observers, but a common theme among many users is entrance into another world. This other visionary world often seems more real than terra firma. Modern trip reports, though, if we're trying to get a view into what was might have been going on in Newell Knight's mind, modern trip reports of nightshade plant ingestion, they help to contextualize what may have been happening in his brain space when the first miracle of the church was performed. And this is what solanacea intoxication feels like in the mind of the user. This is a male user with the screen name of Weird, and this user reported ingesting datura at the age of 20. It's a bit of a long quote, but I think it illustrates the mindset of datura ingestion. Quote, "The onset involved losing touch with material reality. Things appeared and disappeared and seemed in between constantly. A great many visitors came and spoke to me. It seemed as though people I have known throughout my past were coming back and reminding me of lessons that I learned. Mythical characters, holy men, teachers, fictitious characters, even TV personalities, past masters, all reminded me of insights that I gleaned from them." Messages being a takeaway from this, right? "I recall feeling as if a woman were embracing me and I fell into her cloak. I recall feeling as if I was falling in whichever direction I struggled against. I so exerted myself that I then decided to give up and just fall. It was after a period of intense fear and struggle at the prospect of falling that I finally realized I was floating. I felt the moonlight like a shower of cool warmth. It was like visiting a place I'd never been and knowing everyone already. It was beyond description." They did not share if they came from a Mormon background or not, but that term beyond description sure holds a certain significance for us in this community. They continue, "I felt at peace. I recall resting under the moon and then noticing a tick on me, and then two, and then five, and I couldn't swipe them off. They crawled furiously toward my head. At first, I accepted it, as I had accepted falling, but as I began to think about the situation, it brought dread to my mind. But then these ticks and other crawling bugs were crawling into my nose, my ears, my mouth, my eyes, every orifice. The more I decided to panic, the more I did, and I could feel my airways being choked. Then, as if the feminine character with the cloak was whispering to me, I let go again and accepted death. At that very moment, every crawling thing that was choking me transformed into a ladybug, and in a wisp of red in the moonlight flittered away. End quote. This user then went on to speak to an elderly dog who wished to be free before his life was over. They also danced with shadows, and then they ended up wandering into a stranger's house in the middle of the night. But the user did come away with some observations from the trip, and this is the message that is the takeaway that is very common among psychedelics users. Quote, I still have the impact of these events with me today. I know how to let go. I know how to let life flow through me. My life was greatly enriched. I may never use Datura again. As you can see, it was among my most risky trips I've ever encountered. I will never suggest someone use Datura in the way that I did. Datura is beyond psychedelic. End quote. Another user by the name of Mushroom Magic, they reported similar motor control failures, troubles balancing. And this user actually enjoyed hallucinations such as a cigarette that they tried to smoke three times that wasn't actually there. And while they were in the detox ward of their local hospital, they actually thought that they were in their study searching for their glasses. They even reported telepathic communications where their friends were also intoxicated but were in different parts of the hospital. And this user is very notable because they premeditated taking the Datura, but after a 12-hour period treading in this visionary world, only then, when they were coming down, did they attribute their experiences to the Datura ingestion. It just hadn't occurred to them that what was going on was because of the Datura. Solanacea intoxication, nightshade intoxication, it is a remarkable phenomenon. And the accounts are available all over the internet, mostly from anonymous users for understandable reasons. My overall point is this. For many users today and in the 19th century, plants themselves do not cause these manifestations, but they merely unlock a visionary world of supernatural manifestations which constantly exist around them. So, in the minds of our heroes of the first miracle of the church, Joseph Smith and Newell Knight, Newell was possessed. Joseph had the ability not to just see, but to interact with spirits because he'd been doing it for years by this point. Joseph, quote, commanded the possessing spirit in the name of Jesus Christ to depart from Newell, end quote. And people are generally pretty vulnerable to the power of suggestion, but far more so when they are intoxicated. And as a result, Newell, quote, spoke out and said he saw the devil leave him and vanish from sight, end quote. With the power of suggestion, Joseph was able to turn Newell's trip, operating as a shaman or a spirit guide, from a very negative and demonic, a possessive experience to something positive and enlightening. And this is Newell's takeaway, quote, I now began to feel a most pleasing sensation resting upon me, and immediately the visions of heaven were opened to my view. I felt myself attracted upwards, and I remained for some time enwrapped in contemplation, insomuch that I knew not what was going on in the room. End quote. This was his takeaway, a very spiritual experience. And this visionary experience, it left such an impression on Newell Knight that he was one of the earliest converts to the church, and he was a faithful member until his death in 1847. Now, many converts of the early church, including the members of the Smith family, they perceived and they embraced a world with many layers, what we tend to call the magic worldview in Mormon studies. The physical layer can be influenced by the supernatural layer, and these two layers converge in the form of celestial gifts like scrying or divining. Now, these celestial gifts, they could be realized or they can be enhanced by the usage of hallucinogens, and even many of today's psychonauts, they embrace a world like this, heavily influenced by supernatural forces that can only be understood by the use of psychedelics and hallucinogens. Well, visionary houses of the 19th century may have had books like Cornelius Agrippa's Occult Philosophy on their bookshelf, which informed them of this mysterious world that is unlocked by hallucinogen use. And what we call brain chemistry and altered states of consciousness today, Agrippa called celestial gifts and divine inspiration. Quote, "Some suffumigations," that's smoking, "some suffumigations are of great force for the opportune receiving of celestial gifts. Suffumigations are wont to be used by them that are about to soothsay or predict, which suffumigations indeed do fit us to receive divine inspiration." It puts us in the brain space to receive celestial gifts and divine inspiration. "Fumes doth make one to foresee things to come and doth conduce to prophesying. By certain vapors, airy spirits are presently raised." That's visual hallucinations, "as also thunderings and lightnings, auditory hallucinations, and such things. The juice of hemlock and henbane makes spirits and strange shapes appear," end quote. Now, the mindset, if we're going back to the early Mormons, the mindset of this self-selected visionary population made them susceptible to revelation and prophecy delivered by the Lord's anointed, Joseph Smith. The early church is known as the visionary era of the church, which spans kind of roughly from 1823 to 1837, the ending of which is marked by the flight from Kirtland when the church waxed political and militaristic. But events in the visionary era, they are quite remarkable, and they're frankly unrecognizable from today's Mormon praxis. Maybe not from some like very, very fringe groups of people who practice today, but the mainstream churches, right? This also marks an era when the majority of Mormon scriptures were dictated, this visionary era. More than 110 of the 138 revelations in the current Doctrine and Covenants were authored prior to 1838. Most of the Bible Translation Project, the Book of Moses, the Egyptian Papyri Translation Project, the Lectures on Faith, numerous other unpublished revelations, they all come from this visionary era of the church, divine inspiration, celestial gifts. So let's discuss what these circumstances look like. An observer named Sally Heller Conrad Bunnell was living with the Whitmers while Joseph Oliver Cowdery and John Whitmer were writing the Book of Mormon. And she recounts a memory. She, quote, "saw them come down from the translating room several times when they looked so exceedingly white and strange that she inquired of Mrs. Whitmer the cause of their unusual appearance. But Mrs. Whitmer was unwilling to tell the hired girl the true cause, as it was a sacred holy event connected with the holy sacred work, which was opposed and persecuted by nearly everyone who heard of it," end quote. Well, after some pushing, Sally eventually was told what was going on in the translating room, and that convinced her to eventually join the church when she was older. But the pale appearance, the pale strange appearance, is quite notable here. And it's also notable that she observed this during the Whitmer Farm translation period of the authorship of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith was no longer welcome on the Hale Farm, where the majority of the Book of Mormon was written, after one of Emma's cousins, Levi Lewis, filed an affidavit that said, quote, that he saw Joseph Smith intoxicated three different times while composing the Book of Mormon, end quote. It seems like the Whitmers were a bit more accepting of Joseph Smith's authorship methods than the Isaac Hale was. So once the Book of Mormon had been published and the church started, the first missionaries, they departed for Missouri. They made a little stop in a town called Kirtland, Ohio, and they converted a few folks to the new church. And two of these converts were integral to the success of the church, Sidney Rigdon and Isaac Morley. Sidney Rigdon, of course, he would become Joseph Smith's second in command for the next almost decade. He was a relatively successful preacher with some radical ideas that mapped very well to the new church, and many of his followers converted. Isaac Morley had a farm and a small schoolhouse, which was used as an initial meeting house for the church leadership. This farm became an early settlement location for the poorest converts, many of whom came from New York. The Smith family themselves, Joseph and Emma included, even began their Ohio lives on the Morley farm. And for all intents and purposes, the Morley farm became the first Mormon commune. It's a really cool site, and next time you visit Kirtland, it's like a 10-minute drive away from there. It's a really cool place to go. Missionaries are always on staff, of course. Well, these missionaries, they conveyed the Mormon basics to these early Ohio converts. And let's consider what that meant in the autumn of 1830. Mormon-specific theology and practices like the priesthood offices, communal living in the United Order, God once being a man and the council of gods, following eternal laws, baptisms for the dead, the endowment, feet washing, patriarchal blessings, declaring lineage, leadership quorums, human deification, polygamy, the degrees of glory, premortal existence, Jesus being our celestial brother, family home evening, eternal families through the power of sealing, the articles of faith, the angel Moroni, all of these concepts and ideas and theology had yet to be introduced to the church. What the missionaries did teach was the Book of Mormon, baptism, the story of Joseph Smith and the gold plates and some vague history of Joseph, and a small handful of administrative revelations they may have told some, and most importantly for our purposes, sacrament, being wine of their own make. Now, early meetings on the Morley Farm, they were something to behold. And I'm going to rely heavily on the words of the actual participants for this next portion of the presentation, because I believe it's important to hear the experiences of the people told by themselves. And these are statements from church leaders as well as from antagonists. And I'd like everybody to note the remarkable consistency among these accounts, beginning with the John Whitmer history. He speaks of the Kirtland Mormons before Joseph Smith moved there from New York in early 1831. He tells of, quote, "the enemy of all righteousness having got hold of some of those who professed to be his followers because they had not sufficient knowledge to detect him in all his devices," end quote. And what he describes as supernatural malevolence can very easily be explained through Solanacea intoxication. Quote, "He, the adversary, took a notion to blind the minds of some of the weaker ones and made them think that an angel of God appeared to them and showed them writings on the outside cover of their Bible and on parchment which flew through the air and on the backs of their hands and many such foolish and vain things. Others lost their strength and some slid on the floor and such like maneuvers which proved greatly to the injury of the cause," end quote. J.J. Moss, who was a school teacher with training as an herbal physician, he likened what he observed to, quote, "the poorhouse where there were half a dozen insane and idiotic persons," end quote. And J.J. Moss wanted to steal a bottle of the wine to see, quote, whether it was drugged or not, end quote. However, he didn't have his cloak to conceal the bottle, and he was also experiencing some fine motor impairment, and he was therefore unsuccessful in doing so. But meetings on the Morley Farm, they changed when Joseph arrived in Kirtland, and he could actually control the situation. He could be the guide. He could be the shaman, right? The inherent nature of hallucinogens is their unpredictability. People call it opening their minds, but the trouble with an open mind is that your brains fall out, right? So this represents an early tension that Joseph Smith was forced to negotiate. Joseph encouraged personal revelation, of course, right? But when people get too much revelation in spirit, they begin to fancy themselves a prophet. And that job was already occupied by Joseph the Revelator, as John Whitmer called him. But put simply, Joseph wanted people to have visions and personal revelations, but he wanted to control the experience and interpretations of those visions in order to be confirmatory of his proprietary gospel. Now, the history of the church relates this emphasis on personal revelation, and take note of the specific language here. Quote, "I exhorted the brethren to faithfulness with a promise," the suggestion, "that the pure in heart would see a heavenly vision. And after remaining a short time in secret prayer, the promise was verified. For many present had the eyes of their understandings opened by the Spirit of God so as to behold many things. I then blessed the bread and wine and distributed a portion to each, after which many of the brethren saw a heavenly vision of the Savior and concourses of angels and many other things of which each has a record of what they saw," end quote. And numerous accounts emerge from this incredibly visionary time in the early church. John Whitmer remembers that some had visions and could not tell what they saw. Some would fancy themselves that they had the sword of Laban and would wield it as expert as a light dragoon. Some would act like an Indian in the act of scalping. Some would slide or scoot on the floor with the rapidity of a serpent, which they termed sailing in the boat to the Lamanites and preaching the gospel, and many other vain and foolish maneuvers that are unseeming and unprofitable to mention. Thus the devil blinded the eyes of some good and honest disciples, end quote. Now, Philo Dibble remembers an incredibly chaotic meeting at the Morley Schoolhouse, and this begins with Joseph promising the attendees that they would see the heavens opened, the power of suggestion. This is the initial suggestion that creates the mindset, right? At which point it turns, and many participants exhibit symptoms of solanacea or nightshade toxicity. And we see how important it is to have somebody like Joseph Smith, who could recognize the symptoms of this toxicity, and he could direct the trip in ways that are conducive to his ends and make it so that people don't hurt themselves. When the intoxication just runs its course, then, you know, open minds, and anything can kind of happen. So this is what Philo Dibble remembers, quote, "While Joseph talked, he laid his hand upon the head of Lyman White. He then laid his left hand upon the head of Harvey Whitlock. Lyman White stepped into the middle of the room and bore record of the coming of the Son of Man. Then Harvey Whitlock stepped into the middle of the room with his arms crossed, bound by the power of Satan, and his mouth twisted unshapely. Hiram arose and declared, 'There's an evil spirit in the room.' Joseph said, 'Do not be too hasty,' and Hiram sat down. Joseph then approached Harvey and asked him if he believed in God. Then we saw a change in Harvey." You know, the power of suggestion, right? "He also bore record of the opening of the heavens and of the coming of the Son of Man, precisely as Lyman White had done. Next, a man by the name of Harvey Green was thrown upon his back on the floor by an unseen power. Some of the brethren wanted to administer to him by laying on of hands, but Joseph forbade it. Harvey looked like a man in a fit. He groaned and frothed at the mouth. Finally, he got up on his knees and came out of it. Next thing I saw, a man came flying through the window from outside. He was as straight as a man's arm as he sailed into the room over two rows of seats filled with men and fell on the floor between the seats and was pulled out by the brethren. He trembled all over like a leaf in the wind." Convulsions. "He was soon apparently calm and natural." And Ezra Booth provides some details of a different meeting with similar observations. "Then ensued a scene of which you can form no adequate conception, and which I would forbear relating, did not the truth require it. This elder moved upon the floor, his legs inclined to a bend, one shoulder elevated above the other, upon which his head seemed disposed to recline. His arms partly extended, his hands half clenched, his mouth half open and contracted into the shape of an italic O. His eyes assumed a wild and ferocious cast, and his whole appearance presented a frightful object to the view of the beholder." End quote. Now, these visionary meetings, they became so problematic and impossible to control that eventually Joseph Smith authored a revelation to put down what was perceived as evil spirits, which is today's Doctrine and Covenants, Section 50, and that was given May 9th, 1831, just a few months after Joseph arrived in Kirtland. But eventually, Joseph was able to wrangle these visionary experiences, and he seems to have used them as a stimulation for his own revelation process. And this brings us to one of the most important and influential of Mormon revelations. This is Doctrine and Covenants, Section 76. This revelation creates a different degrees of heaven. It articulates many details of Mormon eschatology. And it contains numerous signals of hallucinogen use, which will be supplemented by an eyewitness momentarily. Quote, "We, Joseph Smith Jr. and Sidney Rigdon," this was a co-shared experience, "being in the spirit," using their spiritual eyes, of course, "by the power of spirit, our eyes were opened and our understandings were enlightened so as to see and understand the things of God." They're unlocking the visionary world, right? "While we meditated upon these things, the Lord touched the eyes of our understandings and they were open. And the glory of the Lord shone around about, and we beheld the glory of the Son and on the right hand of the Father and received his fullness. And saw the holy angels and they who are sanctified before his throne," end quote. Makes you wonder, if other people are in their room with them while this is going on, do they also see the angels, or is it just Joseph and Sidney who are in the vision, who are using their spiritual eyes, who are in the vision, who are able to see it? It's very hard to tell the differences between the tangible world and the hallucinatory world for the people who are enjoying the hallucinations themselves. Well, Philo Dibble remembered this scene when Joseph and Sidney were receiving Doctrine and Covenants, Section 76. Notably, he remembers that he saw the glory and felt the power, but did not see the vision. He was in the room where it happened. And variations in the mindset, the suggestion, as well as the dosage can account for Philo feeling the power, feeling stimulation, but not actually visually hallucinating, while Joseph and Sidney were enjoying visual hallucinations. Dibble also illustrates how hallucinatory minds, they can feed off of each other, and they can share, like two people can share a hallucination when the set and the setting are conducive to it. And when telling of Joseph's appearance, though, Dibble does recount that he saw something that was a minor hallucination. So this is Dibble's account. Quote, "Joseph would, at intervals, say, 'What do I see?' as one might say while looking out the window and beholding what all in the room could not see. Then he would relate what he had seen or what he was looking at. Then Sidney would reply, "I see the same." The definition of see in this is very, very complex and very nuanced, I believe. Presently, Sidney would say, "What do I see?" and would repeat what he had seen or was seeing, and Joseph would reply, "I see the same." Joseph wore black clothes, but at this time seemed to be dressed in an element of glorious white, the vision shown round about, right? And his face shone as if it were transparent. But I did not see the same glory attending Sidney Rigdon. Joseph appeared as strong as a lion, but Sidney seemed as weak as water. And Joseph, noticing his condition, smiled and said, "Brother Sidney is not as used to it as I am." End quote. Well, the church continued to grow in size, and this initial group of visionary followers, they remained somewhat intact as the highest leadership body within the church, with some of them falling away and others joining in their place. Now, for understandable reasons, these visionary practices became far more secretive, and they eventually, you know, ended with the anointed quorum and the endowment prior to the deaths of Joseph and Hiram Smith. And so, in conclusion, and to shoehorn this presentation into the theme of the Sunstone this year, this close-knit group of trusted visionary acolytes, they formed the foundation of the visionary house within the mansion of the early Mormon metaverse. Thank you. Thank you.